Lecture 5, The Beginnings of the Gospel Traditions.
To this point, we have considered some of the epistles of the New Testament. We can now turn our attention to the New Testament Gospels. As I pointed out earlier, even though the Gospels appear as the first books of the New Testament, they were not the first books to have been written. Paul's letters were written earlier, probably sometime in the 50s AD, in other words, between 20 and 30 years after Jesus' death. The earliest gospel was probably the Gospel of Mark, written about a decade after Paul's letters, probably around AD 65 or 70. The Gospels of Matthew and Luke were probably 10 or 15 years after that, usually dated to AD 80 to 85. And the Gospel of John was probably about 10 years after that, AD 90 to 95. With the Gospels, we are obviously dealing with a different genre of literature from the epistles of Paul. The Gospels are not pieces of correspondence, but narratives that tell the stories of Jesus' life, ministry, death, and resurrection. They're called Gospels because they are narratives with a point. They proclaim the good news, the literal meaning of the word gospel, the good news of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. And so these books are not called histories. They're not conceptualized as objective biographies. They're understood to be proclamations of the Christian truth, the Christian gospel. It would be a mistake, however, to think that in terms of genre, these books, these gospels, were unique writings in the ancient world. In fact, these books, these gospels, appear in many respects to be like other ancient biographies of important men. Now, these may not be like modern biographies, which tend toward objective, historically verifiable truth claims about their main characters. Ancient biographies, in fact, differ from modern biographies in a large number of respects. We know about other ancient biographies because some of them survive. Probably the most famous are those written by the Greek author and philosopher and statesperson Plutarch. Plutarch's Lives were a collection of biographies of famous men, both Greek and Roman. By studying the lives of Plutarch and other biographies, we can get a sense for how an ancient person would understand how the ancient genre of biography was to work. It becomes quite clear when reading ancient biographies that ancient biographers were far less concerned with names and dates than modern biographers. What is probably the most striking difference between ancient biographers and modern biographers is that in the ancient world there was no sense of formative influences on a person. So that in the modern world, when you read a biography, typically you'll read something about how this person's ideas and character were formed because of influences on them, from their parents, from their schooling, from their friends in their young development. You get no sense of formative influence in ancient biographies or, on the corollary, anything about the psychological development of character. There is no psychological development of character in the ancient world because the ancient world didn't have psychology. Instead, ancient biographies tend to show the key events of a person's life in order to give a sense of what he or she was really like. Even when a person's childhood is being portrayed in ancient biographies, the childhood isn't meant to show why the person became the kind of person they became. The childhood is meant to show how the character of the person was manifest already as a young child. So that's quite different from modern biographies. No such thing as psychological development. So that anybody who reads the Gospels of the New Testament and psychoanalyzes the characters within them, for example, tries to come up with a psychological explanation for why Jesus does what he does, is misguided. These authors didn't have any idea of psychological development. One of the things that makes the New Testament Gospels different from other biographies of religious men in the ancient world is that the focus of the Gospels is far more on the death and the resurrection of their main character than is typical in ancient biographies. Some readers, in fact, have called the Gospels passion narratives with long introductions. Passion narratives with long introductions. Before Mel Gibson's movie came out, I had to explain to my students what the word passion meant in this context, since it doesn't refer to what happens on dormitories on Friday nights. Passion in this context refers, it actually comes from the Greek word pasco, which means to suffer. A passion narrative is the narrative of Jesus suffering. And so Mel Gibson's movie entitled The Passion of the Christ. I should point out, by the way, that some of the publicity for The Passion of the Christ indicates that Mel Gibson's intent is simply to show what happened to Jesus during his last hours in a manner that's consistent with what the Gospels say. So it's just like the Gospels. In fact, The Passion of the Christ is not just like the Gospels. There are wide-ranging differences between what the Gospels say about what happened to Jesus in his last hours and what's portrayed in Mel Gibson's movie. For one thing, just sort of the most obvious thing, in the Gospels of the New Testament, Jesus is crucified in about three words. The Gospel writers could have given a blow-by-blow account. They could have shown how long and dragged out it was and how much pain and suffering was involved in this. There are other ancient accounts of people suffering where you do get a blow-by-blow account. Not the Gospel writers. They're not concerned with that. They simply say, and he got flogged, then he got crucified. Mel Gibson, however, his film is obsessed with all of the pain and the suffering. It's not like the Gospels. The Gospels are not obsessed with that particular issue in the least. Moreover, it's important to stress that the Gospels are passion narratives with long introductions. If you take the passion out of the context of the long introduction, then you have a very different understanding of who Jesus was. Of course, in Mel Gibson's movie, the Jesus who's portrayed is a Jesus whose pain is our gain. The more pain, the more gain. The more gain you need, the more pain you need. And so Jesus is beaten to a bloody pulp and then gets up for more. Why? Well, there are a lot of sins that need to be atoned for, and so there has to be a lot of suffering. That may be good theology or bad theology, but it is not gospel theology. The New Testament gospels simply don't have that perspective. Back to the New Testament gospels. The gospels go under the names of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They are, in fact, however, written anonymously. The titles in our gospels are later additions to the text. The titles, the Gospel according to Matthew, the Gospel according to Mark, etc., were not original to the Gospels themselves. These books are all written anonymously. You'll note when you read the Gospels that they are all told in the third person about what they were doing. Even the Gospel of Matthew, for example, which has an account of the calling of Matthew, the tax collector, to be one of Jesus' disciples. It's not narrated in the first person about what happened to me. It's narrated in the third person about what happened to him. No indication in Matthew's gospel that it's being written by somebody named Matthew. Where did these titles come from then? Well, the titles themselves are indications that the named authors were not actually the authors of these books, because of the way the titles are phrased. Matthew is called the Gospel according to Matthew. Now, if Matthew wrote a gospel, he wouldn't call it the Gospel according to Matthew. That's somebody else telling you who is responsible for the gospel. This tradition that Matthew wrote Matthew and that John wrote the Gospel of John, in other words, two of Jesus' disciples, Matthew the tax collector and John the beloved disciple, that they're two of the gospel authors, comes from the second century. Some decades after the Gospels were written, as is the tradition with Mark, who is thought to be a companion of Peter, and Luke, who is known to be a companion of Paul. In the second century, some decades after the books were written, Christians wanting to know that these books are written by apostolic authorities, written by apostles or by companions of apostles, attached the names Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John to them. In fact, we don't know the identity of the authors of these Gospels. They're written anonymously. What we can say for certain about these authors is that all of them were highly educated, literate Greek-speaking Christians of at least the second generation. It's an important point. They're all highly educated, they're literate, they're Greek-speaking Christians of a later generation. I stress that because Jesus' own followers were not highly educated, literate, Greek-speaking Christians. Who were Jesus' followers? Well, according to the Gospels themselves, they were peasants from Galilee. The native language in Galilee was Aramaic. Most peasants in the ancient world simply could not afford the time or the leisure to get an education, which meant most peasants simply spoke their native language and couldn't speak another language, let alone read another language, let alone write another language. The best estimates indicate that in the ancient Roman world, at the best of times, 10 to 15% of the population could read and write. And when I say write, I mean they could sign their name. 10 to 15%, which means 85 to 90% of people could not even read, let alone write their name. Well, how many people could write a book, compose a book? Well, not very many people, only the upper echelons. Well, who were in the upper echelons? The wealthy and the elite. The followers of Jesus were not wealthy and elite. They were lower class peasants. They were fishermen and the like, who probably never went to school, certainly could not compose books, and almost certainly did not speak Greek in the first place. Now, it's entirely possible that John, just to take one example, that John started out as a lower class peasant fisherman in Galilee who spoke Aramaic. According to the book of Acts, chapter 4, verse 13, he was in fact illiterate. Well, so suppose he started out that way. Now, it's possible that after the resurrection, he went back to school and he learned Greek, and then he learned Greek composition and he got pretty good at it. And at the end of his life, he composed a gospel. I mean, it's theoretically possible, but for most historians, it seems somewhat unlikely. And given the fact that John doesn't claim to be written by John, there's really no reason for thinking that Jesus' disciple John actually wrote the book. So too with the other Gospels. These are anonymous writings by Christians living in later decades nearer the end of the first century. But if they were not companions of Jesus who wrote the Gospels, how and where did they get their information? How do they know the stories that they narrate about Jesus that they write down in their Gospels? Since the Gospels appear not to be eyewitness accounts, they don't claim to be eyewitness accounts, and there's nothing in them to suggest they're eyewitness accounts of the things that Jesus said and did, they appear to be based on oral traditions that had been in circulation about Jesus for the decades between his life and the time the Gospels were written. If the Gospels are written between 65 and 95 AD, that means there's a time gap of between 30 and 35 years between the time of Jesus' death and the first accounts of his life. 30 to 35 years. What was happening during those 30 to 35 years? Well, there were a lot of things happening in the Roman Empire during the first century, but the thing that was most important for Christianity is that it was spreading throughout the empire in major urban areas, as I mentioned when I talked about the Apostle Paul. People were converting to become believers in Jesus. Now, it's not true that that early Christianity completely turned the Roman Empire on its ear. It's not true that thousands and thousands and thousands of people were converting. But dozens were, or hundreds were, and in different regions throughout the Mediterranean as missionaries would go to different places. These missionaries, like Paul, were trying to convince people to stop worshiping their pagan gods, to worship the one God of Israel, and accept Jesus as his son who died for their sins. How could they convince people to believe in Jesus? They had to tell them stories about Jesus. Missionaries are telling stories about Jesus to convince others to believe in him. These missionaries are spread out throughout the Mediterranean, throughout the Roman world. When a missionary would convert somebody to believe in Jesus, that person then would convert their family members and their friends and their neighbors. When their neighbor converts, the neighbor would convert her family. Her husband then would convert a business associate who would convert his wife, who would convert her neighbor. And so it went. Who's telling the stories about Jesus in this context of the widespread of Christianity? the vast majority of people telling the stories were not people there who were there to see these stories take place. They're people who've heard the story. Well, where did you hear the story? I heard it from my husband. Where did your husband hear it? He heard it from his neighbor. Where's his neighbor? He heard it from his business associate. Where did he hear it from? He heard it from a guy who lived across the street. Where did he hear it from? He heard it from his wife. Where did he hear it from? She heard it from a visiting missionary. Where did the missionary hear it from? Heard it from some other missionary. Virtually everybody telling these stories is telling the stories even though they hadn't been there to see these things happen. And this is taking place for decades. That's the only way we can explain the spread of Christianity throughout the Roman Empire in the 35 to 65 years between Jesus' death and the first accounts of his life. Now, what happens to stories when they're in broad oral circulation? The example I usually use with my students is of a game many of them played when they were younger kids, sitting in a circle at a birthday party. One child tells a story to the next child, the game called Telephone. And it goes around the circle. One child tells it to the next, tells it to the next, tells it to the next. By the time it goes all the way around the circle and comes back to the first child, it's a different story. If it weren't a different story, it'd be a pretty silly game to play. Because I just heard that story. The fact is, the story gets changed as it circles around the room. What happens if you play the game Telephone, not just one afternoon at a birthday party among people from the same socioeconomic class who speak the same language at the same time? What happens if you play it for 35 to 65 years among people who live in different countries, who speak in different languages, who have different contexts and different concerns? What happens to the stories? The stories inevitably change. Sometimes the stories just change accidentally. Sometimes people change the story because they want to make a point. These people who are telling the stories are telling them for a point. They're not telling them in order to give objective history lessons about what happened in first century Palestine. They're trying to convert people to believe in Jesus. Sometimes they change the stories. It should not be thought that because the ancient Roman world was an oral culture, therefore, great care was taken to preserve these stories accurately. Sometimes that's claimed. Well, in oral cultures, everybody tells the story the same way. In point of fact, cultural anthropologists have shown that that isn't how it works at all. That in oral societies, there simply isn't a concern for verbatim accuracy the way you have that concern in written cultures. The reason you have that concern in written cultures is because you can check to see if there's accuracy. So the very notion that there should be accuracy came about when written cultures developed. In oral societies, though, people who tell stories understand that when you tell a story, you tell it for the occasion. You tell it based on the audience that you're talking to and what their situation is and what it is you want to stress. So you'll tell the same story differently to different audiences at different times. That's how oral cultures function, and that's what probably happened within the storytelling tradition of early Christianity. Storytellers modified the stories they told about Jesus based on the context within which they were telling the stories. Now, this isn't just a theory that I happen to have or that New Testament scholars have dreamt up. In fact, there's solid evidence that when Christians told the stories about Jesus over these 35 to 65 years and beyond, they were changing the stories. The evidence we have is the fact that we have different accounts of the same story, and we can compare these accounts with one another. And when we compare these accounts with one another, we see that there are differences among them. And so what I want to stress is that the differences among our surviving written accounts, the differences that survive among our surviving written accounts shows that the stories were being changed probably not just at the level of writing, but the stories were probably being changed at the oral level before anybody wrote them down. Okay, so just so you're clear on how I'm imagining this. Jesus' ministry took place probably in the 20s A.D. He dies around 30. We aren't sure which year. It might be 30, it might be 33, it might be 29. Scholars differ about which year. Sometime in there, Jesus died. The first Christian writings we have are 20 years later, the writings of Paul, who hardly ever mentions stories about Jesus. The first Gospels don't come about until around the year 65 or 70. And then they have Gospels written until about the year 90. Gospels continue to be written into the second century. They continue to be written. But all these Gospels, where are they coming from? They're not coming from notes that somebody took when Jesus gave the Sermon on the Mount. There were no notes. The stories are coming about as people told and retold the events of Jesus' life, both the things he said and the things he did. These stories are in circulation for decade after decade after decade. They get changed in the process. Eventually, somebody decides to write them down. Why didn't they write them down earlier? Well, we don't know. It may be that there were Christians who wrote down the accounts earlier, and we don't have the accounts anymore. But it may be that the earliest Christians saw no need to write down the accounts of what Jesus said and did, because they thought the end of the world was coming right away. And for whom would they be writing these things? There's not going to be a posterity who needs to know this. And so probably, at least in Paul's lifetime, it probably didn't occur to people that this would be an important thing for posterity. Eventually, though, four authors that we have in the New Testament wrote these stories down. They used some of the same sources. So as I indicated earlier, Matthew and Luke had access to Mark's account, and so they used Mark's account. But where did Mark get his stories? And where did Matthew and Luke get their other stories? Where did John get his stories? They got them from the oral tradition as people told and retold the stories. And as they told and retold the stories got changed. The evidence is the circumstance that we have these various stories in different forms. Let me give you a number of examples. It's commonly known from the Gospels that the disciple Peter denied Jesus three times. In one Gospel, Jesus tells Peter that Peter will deny him three times before the cock crows. In another Gospel, it's indicated that Peter will deny Jesus three times before the cock crows twice. Well, which is it? Is it before the cock crows or before the cock crows twice? Now, one way to reconcile discrepancies in the Gospels is to smash the Gospels together so you end up with one big Gospel and where everything happens on multiple occasions. So there was a book that was written back in the 1970s, I think, called The Life of Christ in Stereo, where this fellow had the idea of taking the four Gospels and putting them all together so that you come up with the one big true story. And so what do you do about Peter's denials? Well, according to The Life of Christ in Stereo, Peter denied Jesus six times. Three times before the cock crowed, and three times before the cock crowed twice. So that's one way to reconcile things. In fact, when you read the denials of Peter, he denies Jesus to different people in different Gospels. It's very hard to reconcile these accounts. Or another simple incident. These are minor details, but they show the kinds of discrepancies you get. In the Gospel of Mark, there's a Jewish leader named Jairus who wants Jesus' help because his daughter was on the verge of death. And while he's talking to Jesus, the daughter dies. And the servants of Jairus come up to him and say, "Don't bother the master anymore. She's died already." In another gospel, Matthew, what happens is Jairus' daughter has already died before he comes to see Jesus, and he comes to ask him to raise her from the dead. Well, which is it? Had she died already or had she not died? The way you resolve that, by the way, if you want to smash all the Gospels together, is that Jairus actually on two different occasions came up to Jesus. One time his daughter was dying, and then he raised her from the dead. Then another time she died already and came again a second time. So you can reconcile a lot of things. But there are other things that are hard to reconcile and other discrepancies that, in fact, are of rather important matters. For example, it's rather important that Jesus cleanses the temple in the Gospels. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, this is virtually the last public act of Jesus. Jesus goes into the temple, overturns the tables of the money changers, drives out those who are selling animals, and proclaims that this temple is to be a house of prayer for all the nations, but you have made it a den of thieves. The leaders of the temple get upset with this action of Jesus, and so they decide that Jesus must be taken care of, and this is what leads to his death. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's striking, however, when you read the Gospel of John. Because in the Gospel of John, Jesus cleanses the temple as the first thing that he does. It's in chapter 2, 3 years before he dies. Well, which is it? Is it the beginning of his ministry or at the end of his ministry, depending which Gospel you read? And of course, if you smash them together, you say he cleansed the temple twice. Other things cannot be reconciled very easily. When did Jesus die? Well, now that's a fairly simple question, and you would expect a simple answer. Specifically, what day did Jesus die on? It's interesting that different Gospels give a precise date for Jesus' death. All of them agree that Jesus died sometime during the Passover feast. Let me give you a little bit of background. The Passover feast was and is an annual festival of the Jews that commemorates the Exodus from Egypt. The children of Israel have been enslaved to the Egyptians for hundreds of years. God raises up a Savior, Moses, whom he's going to use to set his people free. Moses brings 10 plagues against the Egyptians, and the 10th plague, the worst of all, is that the firstborn Egyptian is of every household, the firstborn child is going to die. God tells Moses to have the children of Israel to kill a lamb that afternoon, to spread the blood on the doorpost and the lintel of the door of the house they're in, so that when the angel of death comes, he will pass over the house of the Israelites and go to the houses without the blood and kill the firstborn in those houses. It happens. They spread the blood. Angel of death comes, kills the firstborn. The Pharaoh sends out the people, the children of Israel. They escape through the Exodus. They go to the Red Sea, parting the Red Sea, Charlton Heston, that whole scene, and they escape. Every year that was commemorated in Israel by having a special Passover meal that would commemorate the Exodus. They would eat bread, a special unleavened bread, drink several cups of wine. They would eat bitter herbs. The day before they ate the Passover, they would prepare for it. They'd prepare the meal. Now, the only tricky thing in what I have to say is this. You need to remember that in Jewish reckoning, the day starts when it gets dark. The day begins when it gets dark. So the next day is in the evening. So the evening begins the next day. Not with us, you know, right after midnight, but when it gets dark. The day of preparation for the Passover is the day they prepare the Passover. That evening is the next day they eat the meal. Okay? In the Gospel of Mark, Jesus' disciples ask him, where do you want us to prepare the Passover? So Jesus tells them. They prepare the Passover, and that night they eat the Passover meal. Afterwards, Jesus goes to the Garden of Gethsemane, gets arrested, betrayed and arrested, spends the night in jail. The next morning, he appears before the Roman governor Pontius Pilate, who condemns him to death, and he's put on the cross at 9 o'clock in the morning on the day of Passover, after they've eaten the Passover meal. Okay? Gospel of Mark, chapter 14, 12, chapter 15, verse 25. The Gospel of John also indicates that Jesus died sometime around the Passover, but in John's Gospel, it's different. The disciples don't ask, where do you want us to prepare the meal? They don't have the cup and the bread, as in the other Gospels. They do have a last meal, after which Jesus is arrested, spends the night in jail, put on trial before Pontius Pilate the next morning, and Pilate condemns him to death, and we're told exactly when it was. John chapter 19, verse 14, this was the day of preparation for the Passover, just after noon. The day of preparation for the Passover, according to the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus lived through that day, had a meal that night, and then got arrested. The Gospel of John has Jesus die a day before he dies in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's a discrepancy. It's a discrepancy that can't be reconciled because in one gospel he dies the day after the Passover is eaten, and in the other gospels he dies the day before the Passover is eaten. There are larger differences. Did Jesus ever preach about his own identity, who he was? He doesn't in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but that's all he preaches about in John. Is Jesus willing to do miracles to prove that what he says about himself is true? In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, he refuses to do any miraculous signs of his identity, and he rejects the doing of signs as a satanic temptation. Not in the Gospel of John. In the Gospel of John, he does his miracles precisely to prove who he is. There's a wide range of discrepancies among the Gospels in details of their stories. Why are there these discrepancies? Because these Gospels represent accounts that had been written down based on oral traditions that were in circulation year after year. These gospel writers heard the stories and they wrote them down the way they heard them. Or they read them and wrote them down the way they read them, or they changed them once they read them. Matthew and Luke used Mark and copied many of his stories, but changed many of the stories as well. These people were far less concerned with what we would think of as historical accuracy than with what we might call theological appropriateness. They were concerned with giving the theological message of who Jesus was based on the stories that they heard about him. And so, it's important when studying the Gospels to study each Gospel on its own terms, to see what its own perspective is, given the fact that there are different perspectives from different Gospels based on different oral traditions. Rather than interpreting these Gospels as all providing the same perspective, we have to see they each provide different perspectives and study them individually for what each of their authors has to say.